et cetera, in it. But they read the statement as well. And Gloria Steinem has something to do with it. She actually, you know, for being recruited to the CIA when she was young, she was part of the Women Against the DMZ going over to Korea, calling for non-militarist solution, which sounds all very poignant now. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And I haven't been doing a lot about, I've been doing a fair amount on Ukraine, but there's more to be done, and I was hoping for a ceasefire and an end so I could start talking about some of the more complexities of the story, if you will, which there are some. There's a guy named David Gibbs, who's sort of Chomsky's understudy, who talks about a symmetric responsibility for this this terrible onslaught that's happening. Missed opportunities and all that, too. So I guess I'm going to have to just, you know, do it anyway, even though it's more difficult now. We've got Oh, my car? Just merci beaucoup. My ride's not too tight. I thought my fly was... No, never mind. Okay, that was Aaron helping me out and getting me on the road here. And appreciate that. Never mind. I'll think about that later. I was supposed to do the intro here. I've got some economic issues, but of course the Supremes, who wanted to do this deal at the very end of their session and get out of town, well, they're not going to be able to. I guess there was a leak of some document at an earlier reproductive autonomy issue. I think it might have been, I don't know. I just remember hearing that somebody was recounting that. But the second half hour will be some economic issues, including a guy named Josh Bivens from the Economic Policy Institute, which is, I guess, sort of funded by some labor groups. Nothing the matter with that. Talking about how nobody's talking about corporate productivity, 15%, record high. Could that have anything to do with inflation? You think? Well, you don't hear it on the radio. Some people don't think about it. So he does a think about it. I also have a segment from TaxCast. Now, it's very UK, very, very UK, but I like it. It's sort of a regular feature. I don't usually play all of it necessarily. I have just the conversation with one of their activist analysts in this segment. So, nothing from Mumia Abu-Jamal. The most recent thing he did was about the execution of that Congolese refugee in on the street in Grand Rapids, was it, in Michigan? It's worth your attention. It's a well-crafted essay. I think he's working on a book and maybe his legal case, like I always say. I hope so. Tomorrow's show, which is also in the can, is a deconstructed story interview with Danziger, who you might not have heard about either. There were 3 hours on the power of big oil, and they didn't mention Chevron's Chernobyl in the Amazon, which is what people call the devastation of the oil wastes in Ecuador. And, so it's a nearly an hour-long interview and then ending with that Mothers for Peace segment that I already foreshadowed. So that's tomorrow's show. I think I've run down what's happening. The first deconstructed segment is kind of repackaged, but it has this sort of behind the machinations that brought us this Supreme Court, I believe is the way to put it. Other issues, too, and that's with Ryan Grimm. They don't say it on their fundraising appeals. They make fundraising for their podcast support and for their journalism support. But they're being sued by Rick Prince. I've been calling him the mercenary king. Rick Prince, the mercenary king, consorting with Saudis and having a corporation in China and perhaps selling some stuff to the Russians at some point, maybe the Wagner Group. I don't know. That's sort of the substance of the thing. I need to look into it more. But if you want to look into that, I think they're being guarded about what they say on broadcast about the case that they're having to defend against. So how about that? So 5 minutes in, and it's time for me to start this segment and tell you that Radio Free Labor is coming up. But also, in lieu of mentioning or having a piece with Mumi Abu-Jamal, we'll get right to the usual segment from Amy Goodman, Breaking the Sound Barrier. But I should tell you about the open house for Books to Prisoners at the IMC this afternoon. Now, they have books and stuff down in the basement, so I don't know. I think they might have the open house up in the big open area where everybody can be distant masked if you like. Talk to them about the books they need. I think they just had a book sale. I don't know that they're calling for people to bring in books. You might not do that on this occasion, but check with them. There will be a book article about the Books to Prisoner Project in the upcoming Public Eye, which is going to press this week. So you can find that online in a bit, too, if you want to read about it. Don't have the time to impromptu go over to Books for Prisoners and find out. If you do want to go over and you do have a dictionary that you don't use anymore, dictionaries are one of the things I know that they still have a call out for, because everybody needs a dictionary. Okay, events also in Urbana. There's another one. Free Comic Book Day. That's today, 11 to 1, midday, and then 2 to 4 is the IMC, just to repeat that. Tomorrow there's a virtual 2 to 3 o'clock Glass Room Poets, a virtual poet reading. Those events are both by the Urbana Free Library. The Free Comic Day is that, if I didn't say for all ages, so they may have that other section of comic books. Interesting cast of poets. Looks like 6 poets reading tomorrow, so you can find that online at the Urbana Free Library. So, a couple of CSAs, have a good weekend, enjoy it. Going to be sweltering through next week, but then enjoy this while you can, I guess they say. All right. Go right to Amy Goodman's Breaking the Sound Barrier, and no surprise what the issue is here.
Will safe abortion fall victim to a supremely conservative court? I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The U.S. Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. is truly august. Its Corinthian columns and ornate pediments reminiscent of ancient Rome's Temple of Mars Ultor, erected by Emperor Augustus to commemorate Mars, the god of war, in his role as avenger. Augustus employed the imperial design to convey that a new order had arrived after quelling a civil war that had consumed the region for 50 years. 2,000 years later, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito has unleashed his own form of vengeance from within the Supreme Court's columned walls, revealed in a draft opinion he authored, leaked by a person or persons not yet publicly known, then published by Politico. This unprecedented leak reveals a majority of the Supreme Court's 9 justices appear committed to overturning both Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, its 2 decisions that protect U.S. abortion rights. Alito's caustically worded draft opinion in the case of Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health has sparked a nationwide furor. A half century of legal precedent and settled law protecting the popular right to abortion could be overturned by 5 unelected justices with lifetime appointments who rule by fiat, just like Roman emperors. Roe was egregiously wrong from the start, Alito's opinion declares. He goes on, "It's time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives," unquote. The people's elected representatives are hardly that anymore, as the Supreme Court in recent years has gutted the Voting Rights Act in Shelby versus Holder, authorized unlimited dark money to pervert our elections with its Citizens United decision, and given carte blanche to state legislatures to gerrymander districts. Now, the Republican Party is organizing nationally to overturn the 2024 election if it doesn't like the results. The current court is even more extremist and partisan than the one that halted the Florida recount in 2000 with its notorious Bush v. Gore decision. That case overruled the will of the majority of Floridians who voted to elect Al Gore president, handing the election instead to Republican George W. Bush. If, as is widely expected, the leaked document remains largely unchanged when it's released in June, then Roe and Casey will be overturned. Roughly half of U.S. states have existing laws or laws that would be immediately triggered to severely restrict abortions or ban them entirely. 16 states and the District of Columbia, conversely, have enshrined in law the right to an abortion to some degree. Several states, California included, are moving to place the right to an abortion in their state constitution. This wave of likely abortion bans will cause a cascade of harm disproportionately among poorer people, people of color, and in other marginalized communities. People will skip needed abortions or obtain them extra-legally, putting patients at added risk, not only to their health, but also potentially exposing them to prosecution. This isn't mere speculation. Last month in Starr County, Texas, Lizelle Herrera, a 26-year-old Latina woman, was arrested for murder, accused of causing the, quote, death of an individual through a self-induced abortion, unquote. After public outrage and organizing by La Frontera Fund, a local reproductive rights group led by women of color, the district attorney dropped the charges. A new law proposed in Louisiana, meanwhile, would make the destruction of a fertilized human egg at any stage of its development an act of murder, punishable, presumably, by Louisiana's death penalty. Justice Alito desperately grasps at history to buttress his anti-abortion argument, quoting Henry de Bracton's 13th century treatise, which mentions punishment for abortions, as if somehow referring back to a time when women were considered property and being burned at the stake for witchcraft should control 21st century medicine and law. Alito then provides a list of anti-abortion laws from various U.S. states enacted between 1850 and 1919. When these laws were passed, women had no right to vote, and most African Americans were either legally enslaved or, after emancipation, subjected to racial terrorism and lynching at the hands of law enforcement and the Ku Klux Klan. Traditions from these eras, Alito says in his rewriting of history, should dictate current law. Under this mountain of repugnant, antiquated law, Alito and his four cohorts on the Supreme Court are attempting to bury the last 50 years of safe, legal abortion, now supported by at least 70% of the U.S. population. If this isn't judicial activism and overreach, nothing is.
We need to focus on electing champions for choice.
That's Catherine Kitty Colbert, the attorney who successfully argued Planned Parenthood versus Casey before the Supreme Court in 1992. She was speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour this week.
We can only do that by hard work. It took our opponents almost five decades to get where they have gone. But let's not forget that this was their strategy, and we too can turn it around.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Amy Goodman, with a hopeful note at the very end there. More on the Supremes and the release of their draft from Gorsuch. Apparently, that was going to be the last thing they were going to do, and they were going to get out of town right after they made the ruling. So much for that plan. This is a repackaged interview from a bit ago, but with a new introduction. Again, Deconstructed is a project of First Look Media, The Intercept. And they are being sued by Rick Prince, the mercenary king. So they are asking for listener sponsors for their podcasts and their other journalism work. just like WEF does, and I hope you support community media and progressive media. Here's deconstructed Ryan Grimm, I believe, doing the work on this.
I'm Zach Young, producer of Deconstructed. By now, you've probably heard the news.
Breaking news about the United States Supreme Court.
Breaking news.
Just breaking in the last few minutes.
Breaking news is coming out of the Supreme Court tonight.
We have huge breaking news tonight, and I can't even believe I'm going to tell you what I'm about to tell you.
A leaked memo appears to show that Roe v. Wade is done.
Politico reporting that it has seen a leaked court draft from February.
A highly, indeed, as far as I can tell, utterly unprecedented leak
that indicates the Supreme Court would overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade case.
The draft opinion is a full-throated, unflinching repudiation of the 1973 decision, which guaranteed federal constitutional protections of abortion rights.
Roe was egregiously wrong from the start, Alito writes. We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled, he writes in the document, labeled as the opinion of the court. Again, I'm reading from the Politico article. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives.
There are at least five votes for that, including all three of President Trump's appointees to the court.
The leak, though, itself here is historic, and the fallout from this report will run deep on many levels.
This would be, if true, the most seismic court ruling in 50 years, most likely.
If overturned, as this leaked draft indicates, it would be up to states to decide whether to restrict or ban abortion.
It's important to emphasize that while this appears to be a genuine draft opinions do change, sometimes substantially. So this does not mean that the court is necessarily going to strike down Roe, but it does make that outcome look very likely. We figured this would be a good time to rebroadcast our interview with Elise Hoag from October of 2020. Ryan Grimm spoke with her about what Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation to the court, which was brand new at the time, meant for Roe v. Wade. So we now present that interview to you again. We think it's still very relevant listening in light of tonight's news. In the interview, you'll hear Elise referred to as the president of NARAL Pro-Choice. She stepped down from that position in 2021.
I'm Ryan Grimm. Welcome to Deconstructed. We're less than 18 days away from the election, and Senate Republicans have spent the past week pushing Amy Coney Barrett through the Judiciary Committee. Anger at the audacity of Republicans for moving so quickly to fill RBG's seat, even as people are already voting for the next president, has triggered a historic flood of small dollars to Joe Biden and Senate Democratic candidates. Here's South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
My opponent will raise almost $100 million. I'm being killed financially. This money is because they hate my guts.
And it's giving Democrats the higher ground in those races. Here's Lindsey Graham's opponent, Jamie Harrison, in their recent debate.
Your words, your promise was that no judicial nominee should be considered or approved or what have you in the last year of an election. And you even named President Trump when you said it. Just be a man of it and stand up and say, you know what, I changed my mind, I'm going to do something else. But don't go back and blame it on somebody else for something, a flip-flop that you're making yourself.
In the third quarter, Harrison raised a stupefying $57 million. And Graham, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, clearly thought this would be a way to even the score. Here he is in a Senate office building this week. Bear in mind when listening that soliciting campaign cash inside a federal building is a crime.
I think people in South Carolina are excited about Judge Barrett. I don't know how much it affected fundraising today, but if you want to help me close the gap, lindseygraham.com, a little bit goes a long way.
For their part, Democrats made the confirmation hearings about the Affordable Care Act. But if the court does strike down the ACA in the upcoming case, Democrats can fix it with a one-line piece of legislation if they control Congress and the White House next year. Still, it was clearly smart short-term politics and has Republican incumbents scrambling to promise they'll protect people with pre-existing conditions and on and on. Roe v. Wade, however, not so safe. Listen to what Barrett told Graham about whether she could ever see Brown v. Board of Education being overturned.
One of the reasons you can say with confidence that you think Brown versus Board of Education is super precedent is that you're not aware of any effort to go back to the good old days of segregation by a legislative body. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I've also said that in lectures that Brown was correct as an original matter. So that is the kind of thing, since I've said it in writing, I felt like I could express before the committee.
Graham also has a piece of legislation that would ban abortion after 20 weeks. Listen to what she said when he asked about that.
So that Roe v. Wade compared to Brown versus Board of Education is not super precedent.
Not super precedent, as I was using that term in the articles that have been referred to.
If ACB is confirmed, opponents of Roe would have 5 votes to overturn it. Maybe they'll blink, or maybe Democrats will make sure there are 6 votes to uphold it by expanding the court. But either way, the fight isn't over. It's not often that politicians talk openly about the forces that are driving the agenda. To understand that, we need to go back to the 1970s, when radical Republican operatives figured out how to link the interests of big business with the grassroots energy of the evangelical vote by manufacturing concern about the issue of abortion, which had been non-controversial even into the mid to late 1970s. That project has now grown extraordinarily sophisticated and well-funded, as Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse laid out during the hearing.
Pretty big deal. I've never seen this around any court that I've ever been involved with, where there's this much dark money and this much influence being used. Here's how the Washington Post summed it up. This is a conservative activist behind-the-scenes campaign to remake the nation's courts, and it's a $250 million dark money operation. $250 million is a lot of money to spend if you're not getting anything for it. The Republican Party platform tells us to look at how they want judges to rule, to reverse Roe, to reverse the Obamacare cases, and to reverse Obergefell and take away gay marriage. That is their stated objective and plan. Why not take them at their word?
That Amy Coney Barrett is on the brink of the Supreme Court is the culmination of that strategy. We're joined now by Elise Hoag, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America and author of the new book, The Lie That Binds. Elise, welcome to Deconstructed.
Thank you, Brian. It's great to be here.
And I wanted to start with Mike Lee, because he made some news this week with a kind of startling assertion on Twitter, and it was a point that he kind of elaborated on during the confirmation hearings. And on Twitter, he wrote, quote, "Democracy isn't the objective. Liberty, peace, and prosperity are. We want the human condition to flourish. Rank democracy can thwart that." Now, that sentiment sounded like awfully familiar to me after reading your book. One of the founders of the Christian conservative movement, Paul Weyrich, said this at a 1980 convention where Reagan and Jerry Falwell also spoke.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And so Elise, who was Paul Weyrich, and what's the link to people like Mike Lee?
Paul Weyrich is the most influential person on the right wing that most people have never heard of. He was sort of the cornerstone that started the new radical right, funded so much infrastructure that dominates the landscape today, including Heritage, including Federalist Society. And he called himself a Dominionist. He straight up said he believed God gave white Christian men dominion over all systems of power, certainly including the family, but including economic systems, social systems, and political systems. And you have to remember, he was living and working to build this infrastructure in the late 60s and early 70s when the country was in the throes of change. You know, the civil rights movement had become mainstream. The gay liberation movement was underway, women's lib, black power. And he essentially said, in order to maintain order in this society, sound familiar? we have got to assert tighter control over these systems. And that requires actually minority rule. So how do we do that? And I think the straight line between him and what Mike Lee said this week is not just the shared philosophy that you've got a white male power structure that is intent on maintaining a status quo against people clamoring for change, but that in fact, this is endgame for a strategy that Weyrich launched, which did involve subverting democracy, certainly through suppressing the vote, certainly through disinformation and monopolization of the narrative, but absolutely through capturing the courts. And that strategy, which was initiated through the 70s and the 80s, is what we are living through endgame this week with these hearings.
And so you and others have talked about the way that he linked up kind of big business interests and this nascent, you know, Christian right in order to create kind of an electoral front for the movement that you talked about to kind of defend the status quo. So, you know, Mike Lee is a part of that. Josh Hawley, too, is on, he's on the committee. He's another religious conservative who talks a lot about right-wing populism and kind of reining in the monopoly power of big tech. Now, he went to the Senate floor recently after the Bostock decision. That was the Supreme Court decision that said that LGBT protections apply in the workplace, essentially. He went to the Senate floor, just ripped into it, and spoke more openly about the alliance that you've talked about than I've ever really seen in public, at least on the Senate floor.
Now, this is a very significant decision, and it's a turning point for every conservative, and it marks a turning point for the legal conservative movement. You know, the legal conservative project has always depended on one group of people in particular in order to carry the weight of the votes to actually support this out in public, to get out there and make it possible electorally. And those are religious conservatives, not even myself, evangelicals, conservative Catholics, conservative Jews. They're the ones, let's be honest, they're the ones who have been the core of the legal conservative effort. And the reason for that is, it dates back decades now, back to the 1970s, the reason for that is these religious conservatives from different backgrounds, but what they have consistently sought together was protection for their right to worship, for their right to freely exercise their faith as the First Amendment guarantees, for their right to gather in their communities, for their right to pursue the way of life that their scriptures variously command and that the Constitution absolutely protects.
So Elise, what's he saying there? And what does a speech like that say about where this alliance is headed?
I mean, it's really fascinating, isn't it? Because they were kind of trying to have it all ways. You've got a founding infrastructure deeply committed to economic rule, which requires alliances with increasingly unaccountable corporations. But that doesn't lead to a lot of foot soldiers, right? Not a lot of corporate executives right. Are going to be knocking doors in the districts mm-hmm. and states that you need. So they created all of this narrative and infrastructure around exactly the constituencies that Josh Hawley lays out, right? Pretty extreme fundamentalists in certain elements of religious society that previously had not been mobilized to politics generally, but if they had been, it had been around an entirely different set of issues. And they had been lulled into politics by actually the idea that they were being threatened by these changes in society. And
their way of life,
right? And arguably that's true. And we think that's, their way of life was not threatened, right? But their way of life was threatened as being the only way of life that was acceptable in this society. And right. Those of us who stand for social progress and plurality and diversity think that is a positive thing. And I think what Hawley is speaking to is the fact that there were always that one sort of crack in the armor, because a lot of these people are actually working people who do stand to lose from the very same aims of this movement when you look at the way that they have sided with corporate titans over working people. And it's a very interesting thing. Now, where does that mean the movement is heading? I mean, I think we've seen that, right? Isn't Trump the manifestation of that right-wing populism and his constant tension with the more establishment Republicans, and he makes them a little crazy? So I think that we are potentially headed for a very big rift in the GOP that has been sort of very fragilely bound together for the last 40 years. And, you know, I think that would be a positive thing, quite honestly.
Now, does Amy Coney Barrett make somebody like Josh Hawley happy finally? It seems like he's saying, look, you know, we're suffering in this alliance because, you know, our people are getting hurt by these corporate titans. But all we ask for is that our status quo be maintained, yet it's not being. But if you get an Amy Coney Barrett, does he finally say, okay, fine, this alliance was worth it? Is that kind of what the implication is here?
I mean, I think that they really do believe that the cementing of a right-wing majority, an unimpeachable supermajority, some would argue, on the court if they have a 6-3 ideological split, plus what she personally represents, which is, you know, this sort of perversion of what we believe the intention of religious liberty is. You know, we define religious freedom as like, I get to do what I want in my home because of my own religion. You aren't going to tell me not to. That, but I don't get to tell you, Ryan Graham, what you should do because of my faith. Mm-hmm. They, on the GOP side, actually completely invert that
and say, anytime I don't get to tell you what to do because of my, it offends my faith, that is, you know, that's religious persecution. And I think they see her as simpatico in that, right? I think that's why they're trying so hard to goad the Democrats into a fight over faith, which, you know, I will give them credit that they did not take the bait, right? And nor should they, because this is a question of record decisions, ability to actually judge impartially. And she has absolutely failed on all of those fronts, but they are trying so hard to make this a war over faith. And they've been wanting this war over faith for a long time, right? This goes fundamentally back to when they fought school desegregation in the late 60s because they claimed that it violated their religion to have to integrate their schools. Their interpretation of their own religious faith and their own religious liberty is so tied up in control, power, and oppression of others that it is not actually an acceptable interpretation through the courts, through legislation, or any other mechanism to embrace that in a diverse and pluralistic society. And guess what? Whether they like it or not, that's what America is.
Elise, you've also talked a lot about the role of women in this particular movement. And so I want to finish up with Marsha Blackburn, who was kind of the cleanup hitter at the hearing. I'm going to play a little bit of what she said and get your take.
You don't fit into their elitist format. You're a girl from the South, from New Orleans. You went to school at Rhodes in Memphis. I don't know if my colleagues have ever been to Memphis or ever been to Rhodes, but you don't fit into their Harvard Ivy League group. You're not a part of the clique or the club. You came to D.C. You clerked, but Judge, you messed up. You went back to Notre Dame and you chose to teach and to have a family. They don't want to admit you got where you got. You earned it. And that is why we are so honored to support you.
What is Marsha Blackburn doing there?
It's so, I mean, I begrudgingly, Ryan, you know how begrudgingly, I actually thought she did an excellent job of what she was trying to do. What Marsha Blackburn is saying over the backdrop of an entire American public who does not want this nominee rammed through, wants to actually be able to elect an ex-president and have that president fill this seat. What Marsha Blackburn is saying to a constituency that the GOP has been losing steadily for the last 4 years since Trump was elected, which is predominantly suburban white women, right? She's saying, you women have more in common with Amy Coney Barrett than you do with those coastal elites. They don't like you. They don't respect your way of life. And by them opposing this nominee, they are actually rejecting who you have chosen to be in the world. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. This nominee is way too extreme for most of this constituency of voters. But what Marsha Blackburn is doing is relying on the allegiance of optics, the allegiance of I look like her, I sound like her, I'm a mom like her, over an examination of what are quite fundamentally radical views that would put off the same constituency of voters. So Marsha Blackburn was sent out there to do a specific thing, which was to not just put a capstone on this illegitimate confirmation that they're pushing through, but actually to try and mitigate the damage that it will do with a constituency of voters that they very much need, not even just to hold the White House, which, you know, the gender gap is so big at this point, it's hard to believe. But she was saying, you know, even down ballot, even these Senate races, even these people sitting on this dais, like Tom Tillis, like Lindsey Graham, who are on the ballot in 19 days, these people respect who you are. The other side does not. I mean, this is literally from the playbook of Ronald Reagan when he was absolutely hemorrhaging women because of his policies and his misogynistic tendencies in his first term. And they were like, what do we do? What do we do? And they were like, I know, let's just name the first woman Supreme Court justice. And they did, with Sandra Day O'Connor. And it saved them that time. I think it's a much higher hill to climb for this to win women voters back to Trump.
And Republicans are pushing such an unpopular agenda here. How is it that Democrats can't stop them? What are they doing wrong here?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental thing that they've done wrong is the Republicans have played the long game. I mean, we lay out in the book that this is the culmination of over 40 years of strategy, almost 50 years of strategy, and the and the Democrats tend to treat each election cycle as though it's a new one, responding to what's happening in the moment, which I understand the allure of that, and there is certainly a lot happening in this moment. But, you know, we have not seen that same kind of long-term strategy in support of a aspirational vision and ideals on the Democratic side in some time. And then I would argue that there is probably a well-intentioned but misguided over-reliance on the norms and practices that sort of bind together a democracy. And I think that's true explicitly in the Senate, where we have a lot of institutionalists. You hear a lot of nostalgia for times gone by where you could work across the aisle, you know, and it's like, I'm so sorry that those times are gone, but how much more evidence do you need that those times are gone, right? So every step of the way, I mean, you can't look at the Coney Barrett nomination without going back to 2016 and watching what they did to Merrick Garland and stopping him from even having a hearing, even though Scalia died and even though Obama nominated him 10 months before the election, right? And that was a high-stakes gamble for McConnell at the time. It was such an abrogation of norms that they basically dared people
to call them out and make them pay a huge political price for it. But they thought it was worth it because they understood the overarching strategy and how crucial this moment was to them in the long game. And they did it and they won and they weren't even punished for it. Right. And so what do? Yep. They go on to continue to break rules. And I think that Democrats have, you know, Democrats want democracy to work. So I give them absolute points for their feelings and their intentions there. But they've been slow to recognize that this is just like asymmetrical warfare where you have one side breaking the system to get minority rule and the other side trying to just play within a broken system in a way that's never going to allow them victory.
Well, Elise, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ryan. And thanks for all you do.
That was Elise Hoge, president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, and that's our show. Deconstructed is a production of First Look Media and The Intercept. Our producer is Zach Young. Our theme music was composed by Bart Warshaw. Betsy Reed is The Intercept's editor-in-chief. And I'm Ryan Grimm, D.C. bureau chief for The Intercept. Elise Hoge's book, The Lie That Binds, was published by Strong Arm Press, of which I'm a co-founder. If you'd like to support Deconstructed, go to theintercept.com/give. Your donation, no matter what the amount, makes a real difference. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so you can hear it every week. If you're subscribed already, please do leave us a rating or review. It helps people find the show. And if you want to give us feedback, email us at podcasts@theintercept.com. Thanks so much. See you next week.
All right. Now some economic issues, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, hopefully. This is from the UK. It's a tax justice network called the TaxCast. I'm only going to play the discussion between one of their gentleman scholar activists, John Christensen. Naomi Fowler is the interviewer. The non-dom situation. Boris Johnson he's notably called the straw-haired Trump of the UK, Bojo by others, has a rip-roaring scandal about tax evasion, which is not a surprise because they are butlers to the world as far as dealing with hot money. In fact, the Lex TaxCast was an interview with the author that wrote Butler to the World. After that, something from Josh Bivens of the Economic Policy Institute, and then Radio Free Labor is coming up at the top of the hour for a couple of hours, labor issues and more.
Okay, John, so non-dom status is something we've spoken about quite a few times on the TaxCast, and as is so often the case with these things, this is yet another example of how oligarchs behave. And we can apply that term to all the super rich, it doesn't just apply to Russians, they just live in a parallel universe where taxation applied to ordinary people doesn't apply to them and borders don't apply to them. Now it looks like the UK finance minister's wife, the Chancellor's wife, has pretty much damaged her husband's political career because there's a lot of anger from ordinary people about the hypocrisy of tax minimisation by the family of the man who's setting our tax policy in the UK and has done absolutely nothing to help citizens in the cost of living crisis they face. She's now said she'll pay tax voluntarily in the UK, and it's important to make clear that she can say, hand on heart, that she's paying all taxes that are due completely legally, partly through her non-dom status. But also, interestingly, she's got the payouts on her huge inherited wealth routed through the tax haven of Mauritius, so she's likely to be paying zero tax there. And this is very much what we call unearned income, so a thing that's so undertaxed compared to what we all work to earn.
Yep, so look, we've discussed the non-dom rule many times, and we've also campaigned for its abolition. But bear in mind the following. Firstly, domicile has nothing to do with citizenship. You can hold an Indian passport, as Miss Murthy does, but live and work in London and pay UK taxes on your income. Secondly, being non-domiciled is a personal choice. You actually need to apply to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs to be deemed to be non-domiciled in the UK. And equally, if you want to pay taxes in the UK in the same way as the vast majority of ordinary people do, then you can give up your non-dom status and you can do this without in any way undermining your Indian citizenship. And thirdly, that when Ms. Murthy's spokesperson claims, as they did, that she has been paying all the taxes she is legally liable to pay, this statement needs to be unbundled very carefully indeed, because it is almost certain that most people won't understand the implications of what is being said. Because most people are used to being taxed on a pay-as-you-earn basis, and they don't receive unearned income from wealth held in an offshore holding company. So, in light of the scandal that blew up, especially after her husband went ahead with increasing the national insurance contribution rates, which apply to most workers, Ms. Murthy has reportedly chosen to give up her non-dom status and will henceforth be paying UK tax on all her worldwide income. But unfortunately for her and for her husband, the reputational harm caused when her non-dom status was revealed is probably irreversible, and her husband's long-held ambition to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom has probably been held below the waterline. That's because if there's something the wider public really hate, it's the notion that there's one rule for super-rich people and another rule entirely for ordinary people.
Yeah, and especially while he was raising taxes on everybody else.
Yeah.
So the UK's kind of really archaic non-dom status has influenced other nations. I mean, Italy, where I am at the moment, they introduced something that was inspired by the UK. At the same time, political opposition in the UK did actually persuade the government to scale it back a bit. And I do mean a bit, because they put a 15-year time limit on it and they made it more expensive after a while. So the cost of £30,000 a year fee, which is over $37,500 a year, to £60,000 a year, and that's about $75,000 a year. More than most of us earn in a full year. So it's obviously well worth it for these non-doms. And tax havens elsewhere also have all kinds of unjustifiable assorted advantages. And really, all of this means that we must redefine the principles that should govern us all equally, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because see, the non-dom rule and the equivalent rules in many other countries come out of a particular ideology, a tax haven ideology. And it's worth just a look at that ideology and understand why politicians think it's worthwhile targeting tax breaks at the super rich people. The argument goes that super rich people are super mobile. They can choose to locate themselves anywhere. Monaco 1 month, Palm Beach the next. They can choose to locate their financial assets and their wealth anywhere. Cayman Island, Mauritius, wherever. So paying tax for the super rich is entirely a voluntary matter. There's a perceptible public sense that the rules, especially the tax rules, are biased to the interests of the very wealthiest people in society. And the wider public, especially in Britain, but I think the same can be said in Italy and in France, are paying high levels of tax whilst receiving increasingly poor quality of public services. So the non-dom rule, as far as I'm concerned, epitomises this sense of fracture of the social contract and the gradual erosion of people's commitment to democracy. And that's why we need this whole new set of governing principles to re-establish some sense of a social contract here in Europe and elsewhere in the world where similar tax breaks have been given to the super rich.
Yeah, and what definitely, and what governments everywhere always say to justify these kinds of privileges for the very wealthy is it encourages investment. And I'm going to speak in a minute to the co-author of a really important report on non-dom status about how much that really is a load of nonsense. But when it comes to the term investment, that's a really, really tricky word, isn't it? Because actually, it's worthy of an entire tax cast in itself, which is something I've intended to do for a while.
Yeah, well, the word investment, as far as I'm concerned, is just a catch-all word used by lazy economists and politicians to confuse the public and obfuscate. But as I'm concerned, much of what is termed investments, particularly inward investment, doesn't flow into new facilities or researching new technologies. Instead, it goes into acquiring or merging with existing businesses, often leading to job cuts, and often consolidating the market power of major companies who might already have monopolistic powers in that market. So, yeah, absolutely. Let's go ahead. Let's have that addition of the tax cast. Let's discuss this matter because we need to bring pressure to bear on the economists and the national statisticians who provide the data on so-called investments, because we need to have a much better understanding of whether all these tax breaks to super rich people are actually leading to real investment in new jobs and new ideas and new services, or are they actually helping just the super rich and everyone apart from the super rich find their situation being eroded by the lack of investment into new wealth-creating activities.
Thanks, John. Economist John Christensen. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. The UK's non-doms. Who are they? What do they do? And where do they live? What does it tell us about wealth and fairness? Now we have a new report just out. For the first time, the data on non-doms has been mined by a team of economists and data specialists. We now have a picture of the UK's non-doms. These are people who are paying a non-dom fee from £30,000 to £60,000 a year. That's more than most of us earn in an entire year. It helps us definitively answer the question, what is the point of non-dom status? Who does it serve? I'm speaking to Aaron Advani of the University of Warwick, one of the report's authors.
You can find the rest, the entirety of that TaxCast episode, about a half hour long typically, by checking your podcasts or just going to the TaxCast.com or .org, I forget, taxjustice.net. And now from Upfront, from KPFA, the great Brian Edwards Tiekert, on In the Morning with Josh Bivens, talking about where this inflation has come from. Nobody talks about record 15% profit margins from a lot of the great corporations in this U.S. of A. So my ears perked up when I heard this was the pivot of the discussion. Other issues also. Again, this is a morning show on the Left Coast at KPFA. You can find it through their archives. Look through their other items as well.
Yesterday, the Federal Reserve announced it is hiking its overnight interest rate by half a percentage point, which does not sound like a lot, but it is the steepest rate hike in more than 20 years. It's responding to inflation, which we have covered a lot here before. And the very Econ 101 understanding of inflation that the Fed seems to be responding to is the idea that the economy is overheated. There is too much demand chasing too little stuff. That is making prices rise. And because workers have power in a low unemployment economy, it risks sliding into a wage price spiral where organized workers demand higher wages and employers start preemptively hiking prices in order to have enough money to pay them and make profits at the same time. Our next guest has done some data analysis that provides a counter narrative about what's going on in the U.S. economy that might suggest some very different medicine than the cold water that the Fed is throwing on in the form of rate hikes. Josh Bivens is Director of Research at the Economic Policy Institute. Thanks very much for joining us. You started looking at the share of money that is going to profits versus wages versus input costs in the non-financial corporate sector over the first year and a half of the pandemic. Why look at that data? What did you hope it would tell you?
So mostly looked at that data because there's a very regular, normal pattern
of how economic recoveries sort of proceed and what happens to the share of profits and real wages, wages adjusted for inflation, as unemployment falls and as economies start to heat up. And the sort of short version is, you know, usually really early in a recovery, the profit share is really high when unemployment is still high coming out of recession, and you start to see some, you know, real wage declines. But then unemployment falls, and workers have a little more bargaining power, and they start to see some real wage increases in the share of total income in the corporate sector that is going to sort of labor payments rather than profits starts to rise. And so that's the normal pattern. And the first thing that made me look at this is, you know, the story about overheating is that, you know, we have skipped right to the latter part of sort of the recovery. But yet real wages are falling. Like, wage growth is nowhere near as fast as price growth at the moment. And that's very odd. This would be the first time ever, you know, we saw real wages falling at this low in unemployment rate. And that just sounds very different. And so what I looked at in the specific thing you're referencing is exactly like the increase in prices in the corporate sector. Prices are made up of three things. They're the payments companies have to make to labor, the payments they have to make to like non-labor inputs, like paying their rent and buying food if you're a restaurant, and then the profit margin they put on top of those things. And normally, the breakdown is about 60% of the price of anything is labor, about 30% is the inputs, the non-labor inputs, and then 10% profits. Since this recovery began, the increase in prices can be explained 60%. By fatter profit margins and less than 10% by labor. And so in that sense, if you were just looking at that data, the overheating story would look very strange because it looks almost like a depressed economy, not an overheating one.
So like, okay, well, first of all, what would explain it? Like, why the radical departure from that pattern? Why would the price increases be driven by early profit taking in a recovery?
I mean, the first thing I go to is like, what is different this time relative to other recessions and recoveries? And it's hard not to just think the pandemic. And then when you start to think through like the economic distortions the pandemic put on the economy, could they plausibly explain some of these patterns? I think they really can. I think what you saw, especially in the sort of early, you know, rapid reopening from the, shutdowns in 2021, you saw a huge reallocation of demand. People basically stopped, buying as much in the way of face-to-face services. And they threw lots of that money into a very specific sector of durable goods. You know, the classic example is people quit their gym memberships and they bought Pelotons. But they also did it at a bunch of other margins as well. Like, a lot of people moved. They used to live close to the office and maybe took public transportation. A lot of people moved to the suburbs and decided they needed a car. So a big surge in demand for cars, both new and used. So you had this reallocation of demand into the durable goods sector exactly at the same time that supply chains made supply collapse in that sector. And so you just had this huge spike in prices that came from that sector, and that sort of spread through the rest of the economy. But I think you only have to worry about that initial shock if you think we've also overheated generally across the entire economy, and it's going to require sort of a bucket of cold water to cool it back down. I think that's where we are now. Like, where are we going forward? We obviously had a big, terrible inflationary spike in 2021 and so far this year, but what will it take to actually wind it back down? Will it happen kind of normally as the economy normalizes after the pandemic, or will it require that big bucket of cold water? I think mostly it'll happen on its own.
I want to ask you about something that may not be a very material difference, but how would you distinguish between a company raising prices just because it can squeeze more profits out of what it does, because it can do some price gouging during the pandemic, versus a company raising prices to manage uncertainty when supply chains are getting disrupted? So they're buffered against a sudden shock in the prices they have to pay.
It's a good question. And it's very hard to tell. And I think there's the difference between those two things. And then I think there's one other angle as well, which is when are sort of higher profit margins useful versus not for the overall economy? And so like one example when they're useful, like if you think there is a long-term trend toward people, you know, let's say over the past 20 years, there's a long-term trend of people spending more and more of their money in restaurants. Then you would actually want profit margins in the restaurant sector to actually rise a little bit, because that's the market signal that we should send some capital to open more restaurants, because that's what people are demanding. And so if we did anything to like artificially reduce profit margins there, we would be stopping a useful flow of resources that the market is signaling it needs. An unuseful one would be, you know, it's the example of like after a hurricane, when water supplies are compromised and people start charging $100 for a bottle of water, like that's obviously not useful. Like no one thinks that's a permanent thing. No one thinks we have to send a bunch more resources economy-wide into the bottled water sector. And so I think the question is also like, is the big rise in profit margins we've seen recently, is it useful or not? Do we think these are permanent changes, permanently higher share of income going into durable goods, and we just need to live with these much higher profit margins as a signal to send resources there? I tend to think they're not so permanent. I think there's some ways the economy will be different for a long time because of the pandemic, but I think you already start to see sort of a normalization away from durable goods back into sort of the face-to-face services. So there's the thing you talk about, like gouging security, but then there's also just the flat, are these useful or not? Or are these just an opportunistic one-time windfall that we maybe don't have to say, yeah, you get to keep that?
Josh Biffen, through specific findings in the first year and a half of the pandemic in the non-financial corporate sector, so we're not talking about the Goldman Sachs of the world, prices go up 6.1%. Labor accounts for about 8% of that rise. Profits account for about 54% of that rise. What does that suggest about appropriate policy responses? Is the Fed sending the slowdown signal with a rate hike going to address it?
I don't think it's going to address that. I mean, I would say I am okay so far with what the Fed has done. I think, you know, they're under huge pressure to do something about inflation, and it is their primary job to do something. I think the rate hike they did yesterday, I don't think it's going to materially, like, really weaken the labor market. And, like, one of the best things about the economy right now, there's plenty of bad things, inflation, but one of the very good things is that the labor market is quite good, especially over the past year for sort of low-wage workers. And that's something that I think policymakers should really try to preserve. And I don't think the rate hike yesterday ruins that. I think what could ruin it is that the Fed just gets ahead of the data and just goes on autopilot of very large rate hikes throughout the year. I'm hoping they won't do that. I don't think yesterday's does that. So I think, you know, I'm okay with what they did. My sense is that we're going to see a sort of normalization of inflation anyhow as the year goes on. And so the need for much more aggressive rate hikes going forward will be lessened. And then I do think there is the issue of we've seen these huge increase in profit margins over the past year. I don't think they did much economically useful. I think it was just pure luck. If you were a used car dealership with a ton of cars on your lot in November 2020, you made out like a bandit over the past year. You didn't do anything sort of smart or useful or good. You just got lucky. Can we do something to, you know, sort of redistribute some of the resources that the lucky people got in that time, and which might provide a little bit of a pushback against corporations who are thinking about doing a little bit of gouging in an inflationary environment? I think, like, an excess profits tax would be a perfectly reasonable response to this. I don't think that or the Fed is super necessary for bringing inflation down over the next 9 months, because I think it's going to come down on its mostly own accord. But I do think it should be an extra thing in the mix. It shouldn't just be a story about we overheated the economy. It's time to give it sort of the ice water bath. I feel like that misses a lot of the nuance in the story and could cause some collateral damage.
I'm curious what lessons you draw about the pandemic policies, like the big relief packages that came out in the first year of the pandemic. A lot of them were basically unprecedented.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think that is almost like what it all boils down to, the debate about whether or not we just overheated the economy and that's why we have inflation or not. And I think there are many people who would say, yes, the American Rescue Plan passed in February, March 2021, that's the root of our inflation today. I don't see that. I mean, if you look across countries, like, the first thing to note is, like, the big increase in inflation we've seen over the past year, it's global. It's happened in almost every rich country. Importantly, a lot of those rich countries did very little fiscal relief for COVID, and yet they saw big increases in inflation. And so I think just looking at that evidence, the idea that that is the thing that drove inflation doesn't seem super persuasive to me. You could convince me that inflation would be a percentage point, maybe 1.5 percentage points, sort of lower now if we hadn't done the American Rescue Plan. I think that's high, but realm of possibility. But then you have to look at what else we got from it over the 2021. And the first thing we got was an extraordinarily fast and good jobs recovery, like more than 6.5 million jobs created in a single year. And just to be really clear, these were not like low-hanging jobs that were just going to come back automatically once the sort of lockdowns ended. We were, job growth was decelerating the last 4 months of 2020. It actually was negative in December 2020. Like, we were going into 2021 with huge uncertainty and no momentum at all on jobs. And yet with the American Rescue Plan, we created 6.5 million. So I do think it provided a bit of inflationary pressure, nowhere near the whole story, but it also created lots of very good things for the economic recovery.
It seems like the other part of this, because in your paper, you kind of compare the profit share in this recovery to other past recoveries. The other part is just kind of how labor is organized. Like, it's a steadily declining share of the American workforce that's part of a union. I mean, how much of this is just that there's not the political organization of the working class to get its fair share of economic growth during a recovery?
I think that's a huge part of the story. I mean, I would say what is different this time is that, and so I think that the disempowerment of labor has just been an ongoing, steadily worsening, but pretty bad story for a couple of decades. And like you say, in the early part of like every recovery, sort of the share of income going to labor in the corporate sector just gets hammered, and basically workers have to wait until unemployment gets to some very low level before they really start to see anywhere near decent wage gains. And that's a real problem. I think we should have an economy that can deliver rising living standards even during that most of the time when unemployment isn't really low. What's different this time is that the sort of excess power of corporations relative to labor in that bargaining process, it usually in early recoveries manifests itself. It's just wage suppression. Just wage growth is almost flat, incredibly low. This time, something changed, and it mostly manifested itself in much higher prices while wages grew a bit. And that, to me, again, just like what is different this time, I think a lot of that is the pandemic channeled that excess of corporate power over labor's power into different ways, and that's what's different. But the general story, that labor is clearly disempowered, and it's a real problem for workers getting decent wage growth generally, I think that's totally true.
I guess the question I'm driving at is that would suggest more of a political solution, like policy changes to bolster organizing, than an economic intervention, like an excess profits tax to temporarily reallocate the surplus that the economy is spinning off.
Oh, totally. So I would say the excess profits tax, I would see as temporary, and I would see it as a very targeted solution to the problem of the past 15 months. I think the problem of most workers in the U.S. not getting a fair share of economic growth is a much longer run problem that needs different solutions. And yeah, I would put the one you just mentioned absolutely front and center. Like, I don't see workers getting decent wage growth generally until there's some way for them to bargain collectively. And given how hostile employers are to efforts to form unions, as we've seen over the past year, it's just not going to work unless policy really starts to level the playing field between those workers who want to organize and bargain collectively and the employers who want to stop them. You know, there's really good legislation floating around called the PRO Act, which would do a lot in leveling that playing field, but that is the kind of fundamental change I totally agree we need for that longer run problem.
Josh Bivens, I realize I did kind of a lousy job at the start of the interview explaining the stakes when the Federal Reserve starts raising interest rates. And we talk about throwing cold water on the economy. The idea is that it gets more expensive across the economy to borrow money. You get a slightly higher interest rate eventually on keeping money in the bank. This leads to less spending overall, less demand. It slows down the economy after extreme hikes. It can even throw the economy into a recession. Famously, about 40 years ago, the Federal Reserve, under the leadership of Stephen Volcker, threw the economy into a recession to break an inflationary cycle and really ended a period of labor militancy in this country. I guess my question is, if you're not concerned about the half point rate hike now, like, what would be your point of concern? What's the threshold that would say the Federal Reserve is going too far?
I think that's a great sort of potted history of the stakes of all of this. I would say my level of concern is, do they continue to push up even when there's data coming in that some of the inflationary pressures are relenting and that the labor market really seems to be softening? That is, that sort of forward progress in driving down unemployment that we've seen over the past year, if that just starts to affirmatively reverse. I'm not positive at like what interest rate level that will happen at, and I don't think the Fed is either, and that's why I would not want them to just every 6 weeks at their meeting just mechanically go up a half point, because there are some lags, and when they have gone too far, we're not going to even know it for a couple of months, and then it'll really have started to go too far. So to my mind, I just want to keep an eye on like the jobs reports, like the one coming up tomorrow. It's obviously not going to be affected already by an interest rate increase yesterday, but sort of those monthly jobs reports, and if we start to see a real slowdown in job growth and how, you know, and start to see an uptick in unemployment, that's when I want the Fed to sort of really, you know, get off the brake. And so I don't know the interest rate level. I just do know the other indicators they should be looking at.
What are the sectors where you expect to see the job growth slow down first? Home construction?
That is definitely the traditional one. You know, the most direct way higher interest rates affect the sort of the real economy through the housing sector. Mortgages get more expensive. demand for new homes goes down, builders think, oh, not going to have as many customers. So yes, I think there, I think as well, to the degree it feeds through, they, and people use debt to buy things like automobiles and other durable goods, that's the other sector. And given how the huge spike in demand we've had for autos over the past year, that was probably going to relent a bit anyhow. And this might be something that really makes it go down. So I think housing and durable goods are two of the places I'd really look.
All right. Josh Bivens, I really appreciate you for taking the time to walk us through your analysis and talk about what's going on.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Bivens is the Director of Research at the Economic Policy Institute.
You've been listening to WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. Thanks for supporting community media.
WEFT, Champaign. Paul's on the road, going to spend Mother's Day with his mother down around the St. Louis area, on the Illinois side of the river, I believe. I think he's meeting his brother down there. He said something about getting on some big new Ferris wheel that's out there. Let me get the theme music queued up and going here, and Radio Free Labor on WEFT Champaign will be coming at you in just a few seconds. It'll be the usual dynamic duo, Gus and